This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, broadcasting from Colorado Public Radio. And this hour, we're talking about marijuana and whether or not it can help or hurt adolescent health. Right now, 23 states and the District of Columbia have legalized medical marijuana in the U.S., and a handful of states allow the use of the drug recreationally. Right now, we're in a state that permits both, Colorado. The effects of marijuana use, whether medical or medicinal, aren't without controversy. There is discussion about the effects of cannabis on the adolescent brain, for example. And scientists face some unique challenges when it comes to studying marijuana. Take, for example, the fact that it's classified by the federal government as a Scheduled I controlled substance. And that means it's defined as having, quote, no currently acceptable medical use in the U.S. But there is research here in Colorado into its potential medical applications and effects. The state's Medical Marijuana Scientific Advisory Council approved a number of research grants this past December and February. And joining me now to discuss how you can go about researching medical marijuana in the U.S. and what we know about the drug as a treatment for childhood disease is a member of the Advisory Council and one of the grant recipients, respectively. Kristen Park is an assistant professor of pediatrics and neurology at the University of Colorado in Denver. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Sam Wong is a pediatric emergency medicine physician and medical toxicologist at Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora. They're both with me in our studios at Colorado Public Radio. Welcome.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having us.
Let me ask you both, why consider marijuana, Kristen, as a treatment for something like pediatric epilepsy?
Well, I think that ever since marijuana has been used, we know that it has effects on how we think and feel. Mm-hmm. And so it clearly acts in the central nervous system. And I think that once we begin to understand those mechanisms, then that opens up some areas of research into brain diseases in addition to the kind of high that's felt. And I think that's kind of how it all came about.
Is there any evidence that the active ingredient, cannabis, mm-hmm. has any sort of anti-seizure effects?
So there actually is some basic science evidence from the 70s and 80s in the same models that we use to test our regular pharmaceuticals. They have tested those models with some of the cannabinoids, and there has been some mixed data. THC, the main component that is responsible for the high of pot, is sometimes mixed in its effects, mm-hmm. and some of the other cannabinoids, including cannabidiol, are felt to be more anticonvulsant. So I think there is some premise to the whole concept.
But it's something that's really still, we don't know that much about, right?
Correct. I think a rat is not a human child. And so I think there's still a big gap in the knowledge.
And what do you hear from parents who want to look at medical marijuana as a treatment for their kids?
Yeah. I think most of them, at the point that they come to that decision, are pretty desperate. So if you think about pediatric epilepsy in general, about 70% of children will respond to medications, and about 30% will not. And it's a hard road for some of those families where children are having 50 to 100 seizures a day, and they've tried a number of different treatments or even surgery sometimes. And so they really are trying to do the best for their child and trying to find another answer.
Because we hear in the media, you know, that marijuana maybe this super drug that might work, but it's not turning out to be that way so quickly, is it?
No, it's not. I think the data is much more modest than the media coverage has given credit to it.
Mm-hmm. Sam, anecdotally, have you seen more families moving to Colorado to get access to marijuana for the kids?
In my role in the emergency department, I think we see a lot of children with epilepsy and seizures who come into the emergency department for breakthrough seizures. And I think we've seen anecdotally more kids coming in who have actually moved to Colorado, transferring their care, and many of them are here to use CBD for their children with epilepsy. Looks like Kristen looked it up. From 2001 to August 2013, the amount of medical marijuana applications for pediatric patients went from 47 to now there's 450. So
wow.
There's been an influx of people coming in.
Yeah, and do you see them in the emergency room?
Occasionally. A lot of these children, you know, as Kristen pointed out, they have pretty severe epilepsy and pretty severe syndromes. And so a lot of them do come to the emergency department to get, you know, emergency medical treatment, typically for their seizures. And that's kind of where we see them in the ER.
Mm. Kristen, let's talk about research. Mm-hmm. What were you looking for in the proposed studies on medical marijuana in Colorado?
Yeah. Well, I think that we wanted to have studies that were looking at actually the medicinal benefits. There's another part of the Department of Public Health that's looking more into toxicities and concerns about addiction. So this was really to look at medicinal benefits of the compounds. We wanted studies that were well designed, that could recruit sufficient participants, mm-hmm. that could really measure objective outcomes in the population that they were studying. We looked for a variety of different diseases, including ones that already had approved indications in addition to novel ideas. And then we had to have studies that were capable of dealing with all the, where the investigators were capable of dealing with all the regulatory processes that are inherent in doing this kind of research. So we took, I think we had about 40-some applications that made it through the initial process, and then we reviewed all of those for scientific merit and budget and those types of things, and then came to those 9 final.
It seems like you have a lot of hoops that you have to jump through,
definitely.
Sam.
Yeah.
Sam, you know, to get this, tell us why.
Yeah, so, you know, I think you alluded to this earlier, Ira, where federally, marijuana is a Schedule 1 controlled substance. So that makes it essentially illegal to handle, to study, to use any of these products. Yet from a state standpoint, we have legalized both medical and recreational retail marijuana. Mm-hmm. So from an investigator standpoint, you know, being affiliated and an employee of University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, the university itself, where we abide by federal rules and regulations. We have federal funding, a lot of grants associated with NIH. And so we abide by federal rules, despite having state legislation that allows medical marijuana. And so what that means with research is we have this large medical marijuana community. The marijuana here is very potent, completely different than what a federal research organization like the NIH or the NIDA would be able to provide. So it's a completely different marijuana strain that we see here than would be seen in research. And then also what we are allowed to do with the marijuana, we have to abide by federal rules. So it's not like what the regular population does here, get a prescription, they go get it, they use it. We have to apply for specific applications such as an IND, a specific mm-hmm. DEA license, and then we get a marijuana provided for us by the government, which is not the marijuana that's seen here. And especially with kids with epilepsy, they're using something called CBD or a low THC or a high cannabidiol marijuana that's not available through research.
It's not as powerful as the stuff kids are getting here on the street.
That's right. Yeah. It's just a totally different animal.
So you have to study. First you have to use only federally approved marijuana grown somewhere else in the country.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then it's not the same strain that the kids that you're seeing.
That's
not
right.
as powerful. That, wow.
Yeah, and it's completely different. And then when we try to study it, you know, so for example, my study, we have to be very observational about it. We're not able to handle, distribute, dose the marijuana they're obtaining here. A lot of is what we're doing is they do what they normally do, and then we get the best available data as we can get.
And that's because it's classified
right.
the way it is.
Right. And I think that, so just for an example, if you look at the NIDA marijuana, that's the federally dispensed marijuana, they have a high THC concentration, which has about 6% THC in it. Mm-hmm. And the content of THC in recreational available marijuana has increased from about 4% up to some strains containing 30% THC. So it's clearly very different from what is available on a regular basis. And therefore, you're not getting the same science.
Is there any way to get around this? Is anybody thinking?
Yeah,
trying to get this changed.
It's certainly people are trying to get it changed with this resurgence in interest in research. So there have been a number of petitions to the government to reclassify marijuana as a Schedule 2 substance, at least, which would still keep it regulated, but will it liberalize the ability to do research? And then there have been some other changes to the process where an extra step that was needed for marijuana research has recently been removed from the process. So there are people trying to streamline it, but it's still a very uphill battle.
This being a political season, is that helpful or harmful?
I don't know.
Trying to get it reclassified.
I don't know. I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Depends who you ask.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. What are some of the safety precautions you need to take when using medical marijuana to treat pediatric diseases?
Well, I think that you have to be very careful in monitoring kids, in looking at the other medications that they're taking, in looking how they are developing, and in addition to monitoring the outcome on the disease that you're studying. And I think we don't know a lot of the safety issues that we need to be careful of. And so I think we need to do more research on that, because the biggest concern is how this substance is going to long-term affect the developing brain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is the content itself. You know, drugs go through very rigorous standards to get contaminants out for purification, validation. When we look at some of these oils and tinctures kids are on, you know, we get worried that there's contaminants as well. Are there heavy metals? Are there pesticides? Are there other, other ingredients that we just don't know about because they're just not as regulated?
Mm-hmm. And you also, on the top of this, have parents who think, as I mentioned before, that they hear what's going on in the news, that this is almost a miracle cure for them. But how good is the evidence for that?
I think the evidence is pretty limited at this point. So there's some data from initial trials that are coming out that are designed mostly for safety and dose finding, but are showing about 30% of kids are responding to this treatment when given in a more controlled setting. But I think it's important to realize that some of the drugs that have gotten approved for epilepsy have a placebo response rate of 30%. So it's really going to be, I think, a longer time before we can determine how effective it is. I think people have this kind of and I think there's a word for it. It's called the natural fallacy, that people believe that just because something is a plant, that it's going to be harmless and that it's going to be better than some sort of synthetic pharmaceutical. And I think that's really a big error.
Well, and we've run out of time. Very informative. I'd like to thank both of you for taking time on this holiday to come out and talk to us. Kristen Park, who is Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Neurology at the University of Colorado in Denver. Sam Wong, who is a Pediatric Emergency Medicine Physician, Medical Toxicologist at Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora. Heading back to the emergency room?
Yep.
Right after this.
Right now.
Thanks so very much.
Thank you for having us.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. In case you've just joined us, we've been talking about potential uses for medical marijuana when it comes to treating pediatric disease. But what about when the use of marijuana isn't medical, but recreational, as it is here in Colorado? Some doctors have expressed concern that we don't know the effects of cannabis on teenage brains as they develop. Joining me now are two scientists who have looked at marijuana and public health among adolescents. Ken Hutchinson is professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He joins us in our studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Pleasure to be here.
Deborah Hassan is a professor of epidemiology at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hutchinson. Are you there? Well, let's begin with you, Kent. Is there evidence that marijuana affects the teenage brain differently from the adult brain?
Yeah, you know, let me start with what we really know. And what we know, there's solid evidence to suggest that marijuana does have deleterious effects in terms of cognition, cognitive processes. So short-term memory, attention, things of this nature. And we also know that there's an association between adolescent marijuana use, especially heavy, frequent use, mm-hmm. and negative educational outcomes. So I think everybody agrees that adolescents using marijuana is not a good thing. Where the evidence is a little shakier, and you kind of alluded to this in the intro, is we don't know for sure exactly what the long-term effects of marijuana are on the adolescent brain.
Mm-hmm. So are there studies that will be examining kids?
Yeah, you know, actually, there have been a number of studies to date, and we've done a couple of studies also. And, you know, there have been some studies that suggest their effects, and there's some studies that basically don't replicate those effects. But I have to say there's a big initiative coming out of NIH, and it's going to start in October. It's called the Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development Initiative. And so the plan is basically to recruit 10,000 10-year-olds, so before they've ever used marijuana or alcohol or other drugs, and then follow them over 10 years. So we're basically assessing their brain, cognitive function over 10 years. And I think that is going to be the gold standard in terms of determining exactly what is the relationship between marijuana and alcohol use and other drugs and changes in the adolescent brain.
I think it's surprising that no one has ever done this before, right? Marijuana has been around for a long time.
It is a little surprising, and definitely people have tried to get at this, but there are issues involved. It's not easy to do. I mean, this study I just told you about, it's an enormous study. You know, we're talking, you know, $30, $40 million. It's very expensive, difficult to do. And, but that's what it takes because, you know, even if you find, for example, an association between some change in the brain and marijuana use, you never know which came first, right? Did the marijuana use cause the change in the brain, or was there some difference in the brain that basically made people more at risk, adolescents more at risk for experimenting with marijuana use?
Mm-hmm. Are you going to be part of this, collecting kids for the study?
There are a lot of us who have applied to be part of it. And in fact, Dr. Hassett, if she's on the line, we actually are part of one team who's applied to be part of this. So we'll see. They'll make decisions here in another couple months.
Now, some researchers find a correlation between regular marijuana use and lower IQs. What do you make of this?
You know, there was one study, the one you're referring to, that found that. And you know, there's been some mixed evidence. And I think, you know, if you ask scientists broadly, you're gonna get some debate about the how solid that is, right? Mm-hmm. Really, we need another large, solid study, to conclude that it does have this negative impact on IQ. We need some more evidence there.
Do you have in your own research, have you done any research on that idea that there's a difference between the brain structures of teenagers who did and didn't use marijuana?
Yeah, so we actually published a study about four months ago where we basically took a look, and both in adults and in adolescents. And so in the adolescent part of the research, we compared 50 daily users to 50 non-users. And we very carefully controlled alcohol use. One problem that we have in this research is that typically adolescents are not just using cannabis, they're also using alcohol and or other drugs. And so you have to, you know, be very careful about trying to identify the effect of marijuana above and beyond other drugs like alcohol. So we were very careful about that, and we looked all across the brain in terms of the typical morphological measures. So looking at how, for example, the size of the hippocampus might be different in daily users versus controls. And we didn't find any differences. So we didn't replicate any of the previous studies that had been done on this particular topic.
I think we tightened up the cord on our tin cans now between here and New York.
good.
We have Dr. Hassan is professor of epidemiology at Columbia University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me to join.
Oh, you're quite welcome. In states like Colorado that have passed medical marijuana laws, are teens then, you know, more likely to be using marijuana?
Well, that was exactly the question that we asked in the line of research that we did. We didn't just address the questions in Colorado, but we took a national perspective, since many states besides Colorado, in fact, 23 of them by now, have passed laws permitting marijuana for use for medical purposes. So we had done a couple of studies a few years back where we showed a clear, strong association between whether states had a medical marijuana law or not and the rates of marijuana use amongst both adolescents and adults. But that was at an earlier point in time when fewer states had passed the laws. And it also, just because you show an association doesn't mean you necessarily have a cause and effect relationship. So one of the things that we wanted to do in the studies that came out just recently was to be able to not only do a more updated look across all these states with many more states on board with these laws, but also be able to do that important pre-post comparison to see if the rates increased after the laws were passed.
And what did you find?
So what we found in the recent study was a resounding yes to our first question, which is that, yes, the states that pass these laws still have significantly higher rates of adolescent marijuana use than other states. But in this important pre-post comparison, we showed no hint of any evidence that post-passage rates of marijuana use in the teens were higher than they were before passage of the law.
And do you think there would be a difference in usage in states that have legalized recreational usage of the drug?
Well, that's in some ways the $64,000 question. Our study doesn't address that directly. I mean, by now, the four of the states with medical marijuana laws have also passed recreational laws, and those laws have the potential to really affect a much broader segment of the population, both in terms of attitudes towards use and availability of the marijuana itself. So our study results can't necessarily be generalized to the recreational use, the recreational laws, and the results also can't necessarily be generalized to adults. But the fact that there is such a strong, consistent relationship between a state having the medical marijuana law and higher rates of use in that state suggests that there are processes going on in these states that may be giving rise to both having the laws and having the higher rates of use, and that it would be very important to determine what those are to be able to do something to potentially lower the rates of use.
There does seem to be such a dearth of research about it. I know there are political and moral issues. That's why there isn't any. But do you see that tide changing at all, about maybe there will be more funding of research?
Well, our study was funded by the National Institutes of Health, the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And a few years ago, the National Institute of Drug Abuse issued a request for grant proposals to do studies to address these issues. And I was just at a conference, the College on Problems for Drug Dependence, where four investigators, including myself, presented results of our study. So I think we're at a point where people are really quite clear about the fact that it's very important to examine broad social processes, including laws and attitudes and public knowledge about the potential harms of marijuana, as well as, you know, some people increasingly believing that it's harmless, to understand what's going on to cause the increasing rates of use and problems associated with use.
Mm-hmm. We in the last segment, we had Sam Wong, a pediatric emergency medical physician, talking about that there is no such thing as one marijuana.
I think that's
Kent, right. There's no such thing, a blanket statement, as marijuana.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point because, you know, things are dramatically different now in states that have legalized. So in Colorado, for example, you know, I think the last time I looked, the state expected to produce 120 metric tons of marijuana, hundreds of different strains, each strain with a potentially different composition of cannabinoids, right? So your previous guest was talking about, you know, the strain they use in kids with pediatric epilepsy, you know, 40-fold less THC, 40-fold more CBD, right? That's a very, very different drug than the kind of drug that a person might use recreationally. And the reality is, you know, more so than any other drug, it's a very nuanced thing in terms of how these chemical properties, you know, change in with respect to the genetics of the strain. And so I think the important point here is, as we go forward, especially in states where we're sort of post-legalization, we have to start thinking about marijuana as more than one thing. We can't just say, you know, marijuana, you know, in kids, you know, used for pediatric epilepsy, and then talk about the same thing in adolescence and you know, in terms of how it damages the brain. We really need to talk about, you know, which strains have potentially the most harmful effects, which strains the least harmful effects, which strains maybe have the most medical benefits, which strains have the least medical benefits. And so, in other words, we really need, I think, a more nuanced sort of experimental research approach to this. And as your last guest alluded to, it's really difficult because the laws, we're still stuck in the 70s and 80s in terms of the laws that govern the research, yet states are free to experiment in terms of regulation. So there's, you know, freedom to regulate, but no freedom to do the research that would inform the regulation. And I think that's a problem.
Deborah, you agree as an epidemiologist?
I certainly agree with the idea that we need to know a lot more about what the kids are using as well as what's causing them to use the substances, whichever ones they get hold of.
Yeah. As Ken was saying, there's so many different strains out there. It seems we have to tweeze out, right, which kinds of strains are affecting what in teenagers.
I think it's really important.
Well, one of the problems with that, I think, is, you know, like when one studies alcohol, you know, you have a certain unit of a certain psychoactive substance that is going to have, the effects will vary from person to person, but you've got pretty much a standardized substance. With marijuana, as with other illicit drugs, it's really hard to think how one would do a broad scale test, like a national study or even a statewide study of what particular type the kids were using unless you asked them all to bring in a sample, and I don't know how many of them would be willing to do that.
Yeah, I think as a quick follow-up to that, you know, one thing that people are working on is basically looking at blood levels of cannabinoids. And so, you know, we can test for blood levels of CBD, we can test for blood levels of THC. Eventually, we can probably test for blood levels of other cannabinoids. And so I think, you know, Debbie has a really good point there. And I think on down the road, it's going to basically take, you know, that kind of an effort where we're looking at blood levels. And maybe that's difficult in adolescence. But I do think we have to understand more in terms of making recommendations for harm reduction. How do we reduce potential harm in adolescents? And we need more science and more research to do that.
Do you think this NIDA 10-year study is going to do that?
I think it's definitely going to tell us a lot about, you know, especially in terms of potentially cause and effect. So which comes first, right? Differences in brain structure or function versus, marijuana use. I think that's going to be really important. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about marijuana use this hour with Ken Hutchison, professor of psychology and neuroscience, University of Colorado in Boulder, and Deborah Sin, professor of epidemiology at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Let me, in the few minutes that we have remaining, let me give you both the $64 question, the blank check question. Let me give you, Deborah, first. If you had a blank check to carry out a study or to do some research about marijuana, what would you use it on?
Wow. What would I use it on? I would want to do, you know, further work to do surveillance of the effects of the laws as more states come on board with passage of these laws, which we can only anticipate since so many states are considering the laws. I think continued surveillance of what's going to happen if more states and the states that have already passed recreational laws is important, and what happens after that. I think, you know, how these laws really are influenced the thinking of kids in terms of their decision-making processes is very important to do. I think the biological work is terrifically important also, and the ABCD study seems like it'll be a huge boon to our understanding what's done, but the attitudes and beliefs are important to understand as well.
Mm-hmm. Ken?
You know, I think especially here in Colorado, we need to spend money on understanding, you know, the safety profile of different strains of marijuana. We have to understand, you know, which ones are most harmful, which ones are least harmful. And so we need a much more nuanced understanding in order to come up with some, you know, regulatory practices and or public health messages that are going to reduce the potential for harm, especially among adolescents.
Are you aware that the rest of the country is looking at you all the time about what's going on here?
I do get that impression sometimes, yes.
You know, because when we said we were going to go to Colorado and go to Denver, people said that's the only thing they talk about is marijuana and its effects and things like that. Is that the only thing you're talking about?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, for me, obviously, it's a little bit different because that's my area of research, right? Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, if you travel around Denver and Boulder, other places, you know, it's not, you don't hear that much about it, you don't see that much about it, but it's definitely there if you look for it.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, any opinion on that?
I must say that the attention that was given to my paper when I should say our paper, because it was a really excellent team of investigators that worked with me. The attention that paper got was quite remarkable. I find that although marijuana is hardly the only topic people here in New York are ever talking about, when you bring marijuana up, people get really interested. And there's such a diversity of opinions about, you know, what should be done about it. And it's just it's very topical right now.
Mm-hmm. I asked this of my previous guest. I'll ask you, this being such a political season nationally, locally, is this a good time to talk about marijuana with them or a bad time? Let me begin with you, Kent. What do you think?
I'm not sure, you know, either way, but I suspect it's a good time. I mean, I think that there's a lot of discussions going on, have been going on for a while now. And, you know, there's a lot of changes that need to take place in terms of the federal laws, but also in terms of the kind of research that we're talking about. So I think it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you both for taking time to be with us. We've run out of time. Ken Hutchison is professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Deborah Sin is professor of epidemiology at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. Stay with us. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The Rocky Mountain Arsenal Wildlife Refuge Complex, right outside of Denver, is one of the largest wildlife sanctuaries in the country. But it didn't start out that way. During World War II, the Army set up a chemical weapons factory on that spot. The plant was producing mustard gas, napalm, an arsenal of deadly chemicals. After the weapon plant was decommissioned, the site was converted into a pesticide factory. It's not the first place you'd nominate for a wildlife refuge. So how do you bring nature back to a place destroyed by humans? And what does wilderness mean in the age of urbanization? That's what we're going to be talking about. Let me introduce my guest. David Lucas is the project manager for the Rocky Mountain Arsenal Wildlife Refuge Complex in Commerce City, Colorado. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Let's talk about the cleanup for the refuge. It spanned over two decades ago. What was the process like?
Well, it's really been a robust process. As you mentioned, it day after Pearl Harbor, they needed to create an arsenal in reaction to the World War II threat, and that led all the way up until 1987 when cleanup officially began of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. So as you mentioned, about 20 years, they were characterizing the site, looking and investigating, and then cleaning up.
Well, what's that cleaning up? Is it literally digging things, plowing?
Exactly. With this site, most of the contamination was windblown, and they were scraping soils and putting those into large landfills and moving on so that the site could be restored. And that's what we've been focused on, is the restoration.
Yeah, now I understand that the bald eagle helped you put the cleanup in motion.
That's true. The bald eagle was an endangered species at that time. Thankfully, it's not any longer. But bald eagles were found on the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began working with the U.S. Army in managing those eagles. And, yeah, one of the bitter ironies of the site is that the persistent organochlorine pesticides that were produced there put the bald eagle on the endangered species list, and then those eagles found their way back and helped us to turn it into a national wildlife refuge.
Does it have something to do with the eggs being fragile?
Exactly. They used to,
in Silent Spring, they talked about
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Rachel Carson, who was a Fish and Wildlife Service employee, she was researching that, and the egg thinning from the DDTs and DDEs was the reason, one of the principal reasons that that species was endangered.
Wow, what a full circle. Yeah. How do you manage this area differently from a refuge that doesn't have a history of contamination?
Well, first and foremost, we're urban, and we're excited to be urban because we are a part of the National Wildlife Refuge System, 560 refuges across the country, one in every state. But most of those are rural, and that's where they've evolved. But this is an urban complex, 16,000 acres just outside of metropolitan Denver. And so how do we manage it different? I believe we try to manage it exactly as the same as we manage our other national wildlife refuges. And that's why it's neat, because we have millions of people that have access to this refuge and can see the work that we're doing there and then understand why we're trying to conserve fish and wildlife in their habitat.
Is there an indicator, you know, the canary in the cave that would be for an open prairie like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, during the Superfund cleanup, the Fish and Wildlife Service was responsible for biomonitoring, which they looked at the animals that were out living in the dirt, prairie dogs, various bird species, badgers, the fish that were in the lakes, and they were able to use those to detect where those chemicals were and when those chemicals were cleaned up. It was pretty neat.
I understand the prairie dogs are a pretty good indicator.
They are. Yeah, they did a lot of work with the prairie dogs, which leads us to a pretty exciting part of our site. We have a great deal of prairie dogs, and they reside down in their burrows, and they're digging and moving around the site at all times. And we're currently exploring reintroduction of black-footed ferrets, the most endangered mammal in North America, at this site.
Because they feed on the prairie dogs.
Exactly.
Wow. You would, I hate to say it this way, kill two birds with one stone. Not the best way of putting it, but you'd be feeding the ferrets.
Exactly. Well, the food chain is a big part of the business we do, and having top predators is one of the most important things that you can do to restore natural ecosystems.
Now, speaking of that, I know you're bringing the natural prairie plants and the animals back to the area, and this includes the bison.
Yeah.
You took our producers on an off-road hunt for a herd of bison, and this is what it sounded like.
We are just leaving, and we are going to go out, actually, where the public can go on our tour route and look for some bison. So I will have to hop out of the car and open the gate here. You just entered the bison pasture. They hang out in a lot of different places, and they have very much a ritual. Bison spend a little bit of time once or twice a day getting water, and they are on the move the rest of the time. So they're on the move right now somewhere. That was a bison wallow that we just drove through. It's an area where they generally get water, roll, hoof around in an attempt to kind of preserve water there in the future. So they looked like they were further up, so we're going to have to probably go down here and then take a right. No, there's one. No, that's a bush. Darn. Oh, there is one. We've got one on the right. So, yeah, we've got a yearling over here to our left rolling around and creating a dust storm. And to the right, we've got two males walking the other way. His head is probably about 5 feet across. He's looking directly at us. He's got the dark, mature head with the tan, more tan brown body. And there he's going now. He's going to start trying to catch up with his rest of his crew. Oh, yeah, look at what... So we're just coming over a hill, and there's about 50 bison here. I can see dust from bison rolling. I can see calves running around the edges. So that male just pushed a female out of the way because she was blocking his view of us. But this big bull right here is not as happy with us. Yeah, he's a little big, and I'm going to move a little bit. The reason that we have bison here, you know, there's a couple reasons. I mean, number one, we have them here to help us with our restoration program. So they are out here working every second, you know, eating grasses. The other reason we have them is they're awesome. They're superstars. They help us to connect with a lot of people. When I started, it was all about protecting habitat. And if we protected enough habitat, wildlife would thrive and everything would be okay. But we've learned now that if we can't figure out how to get kids right now to care about the wildlife, conservation ends.
And that's fascinating. And kids do show up to watch.
Oh, yeah. Currently, we have about 30,000 kids a year that come through in formal programming. But we have 120,000 kids in schools just adjacent to the Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge. So there's a lot more work to be done. But to me, that's where it all starts. Basically, all science and everything that we all invest our careers in is can be found in nature. And if we can get kids to get excited and get outside and get disconnected from the various devices, I just think it's, well, I think it's an essential part of being a human. Obviously, we all are, as humans, evolved over tens of thousands of years. And just in these last 30 to 40 years, we've become so disconnected from everything natural.
That's interesting. So, yeah, we're doing our electronic objects, right?
Right.
But the kids will come out. Families do come out?
Yeah. Yeah, we get a lot of families. And, obviously one of our goals right now is to increase visitation and the accessibility of that. We had just 23,000 visitors in 2012, and last year we had over 300,000. And
wow.
We're expecting to have over 1 million visitors a year.
And what are they coming out to see? What's the attraction?
I think a lot of things. One, proximity. Being an urban national wildlife refuge, they can get there. But I think people do recognize, families do recognize that they need to get their kids outside. And it needs to be someplace that they feel comfortable and they can do that. These baby steps of moving into nature. And so they come out and they look at the bison, they look at the eagles, they look at the raptors, they look at the songbirds, they look at the grasses, they look at the fish, the frogs, anything.
That's amazing because here you are in Colorado, surrounded by, you have Rocky Mountains, you have all this wildlife out there, and yet they are still coming to see your place.
Yeah, and I love that because I think the prairie ecosystem and the grassland ecosystems are far more exciting than those big mountains to our west. But those big mountains to our west are what draw people to Denver, and that's why Denver's probably one of the largest growing cities in the nation. Mm-hmm.
So what would you like to do next? What kind of changes, improvements, whatever would you like to see?
Wow, that's a huge question.
You're giving me the blank check. Because I don't have it. I can give it.
You can give it. To me, I really would love for us to continue to build our partnerships with the schools and with all of the conservation organizations. This is one thing we're lined up on, and we're not always lined up, but everybody is lined up right now and agrees that what we have to do right now together is figure out how to bring kids out, get them excited about the outdoors, and get them excited about nature, not only for their own health, just up and moving, living, but also mm-hmm. that those kids will be the future conservation leaders. So anything that we can do with that blank check to get more kids the ability to get out and have positive experiences, I think that would be awesome.
And any modifications or improvements to the refuge at all? Would you like to see?
Well, in planning for those million visitors a year, right. we are doing a lot of planning. And so there's a lot of infrastructure that goes into that, into protecting right. The main resources that are there that people want to enjoy. And that's a big part of our job, is making sure we have that balance.
So you don't have too many people trampling
exactly
the wilderness.
Yeah. So I think through planning, we can, you know, we can get people to the right spots, and we can allow people to come in and enjoy while also protecting the National Wildlife Refuge and its resources.
How big a herd of bison do you think you have now?
Right now, we have 84.
84?
Mm-hmm.
Aiming for?
Eventually, a 220 is our maximum capacity.
Mm-hmm. And could they turn into bison meals for people if they get too many?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, we have to do population management.
Right.
They will continue to breed. When we have 200 animals, there'll be 40 to 50 calves per year. And the Fish and Wildlife Service can access those animals. And most of them are going into other conservation herds.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
You move them around.
Yeah, but
don't confuse a bison with a buffalo.
Exactly.
The nickel is not around anymore.
No,
to show
not.
People what a bison really looks like.
But it is the centerpiece of the Department of Interior's
right.
logo. It is
right.
the iconic prairie species, and like I always say, they deserve a spot somewhere in the United States.
Well, and you've given them a spot.
Yep.
The Rocky Mountain Arsenal Wildlife Refuge Complex. I'm talking with David Lucas, who is the project leader. Thank you for taking time out of this holiday.
Thank you.
To be honest, do you follow all the rules and regulations of the road if you're a bicyclist? I mean, like, you never zipped and zigzagged over the speeding limit or casually glided past a stop sign when no one's around? The last one could apply to drivers and cyclists alike, and that's what one scientist wanted to understand. Do cyclists, you know, we think they do. Do they actually break traffic laws as much as you think they do? And if they do, why do they do that? Joining me now to discuss the preliminary results of his research into this question is Wes Marshall, is Associate Professor of Civil Engineering at the University of Colorado in Denver. Welcome to the program, Wes.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Well, let's talk about it. Who's more likely to break the law, cyclists or drivers?
Pretty much everybody's breaking the law is what I'm going to start with. I mean, when you look at the transportation system and the laws we have, pretty much everybody is a criminal. And our study, you know, I mean, looking at things like that, and like you said, we've all gone a few miles an hour over the
right.
speed limit. And as a society, we seem okay with that. Like, we're not okay with things like drunk driving, but with those minor infractions, I mean, that's something that we're all sort of okay with. And scofflaw cycling, this sort of breaking the law of cycling, is really interesting because most of us imagine these reckless
yeah.
New York bike messenger type
yeah.
people. And you know, I've seen a few studies where people say that those people breaking the laws make them angrier than anything else. And the thing is, if you look online, there's just venom against these sort of people.
Mm-hmm.
And not even just for the things when they go through red light, but even when they're doing perfectly legal maneuvers, like coming into a lane and taking the lane, you know, people think that is rude. But cycling now is much more mainstream. And, you know, when I'm looking at people breaking the laws out there, you know, they're doing it for the same sort of reasons drivers do, because it's sort of the rational choice in their decision making. And
right.
they're not trying to be reckless or rude. And, you know, some of the other studies I've seen, if you look at the numbers, you know, there's a study from New York looking at the number of people going through red lights in cars. It was like 8 or 9% of people that the first one to the red light went through that red light, even though they shouldn't have been as a driver.
Right.
And the rate for cyclists was around 7 to 9% as well. So it wasn't that different. It's just, you know, the chances of a crash and a serious injury crash happening with a cyclist versus a driver is very different, too. So
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of things that go into
yeah.
these decision makings. And, you know, that's what we're trying to look at with the little survey we put together.
You surveyed 18,000 people?
That's what ended up happening.
That's a little survey.
I was sort of hoping for like 1,000, and it got out there and the internet a little bit. So we got over 18,000 surveys. And, you know, we're just trying to understand who's breaking
yeah.
the law, to what extent they are.
Yeah.
We put them in these different scenarios.
But why do cyclists tell you that? What is the biggest reason why they do break the law, and when they do?
So we asked all three modes, yeah. so drivers, pedestrians, and cyclists. The drivers and pedestrians, they're mostly doing it to save time. the cyclists were doing it for their own personal safety or perceived safety. They felt like they were more visible, and they weren't trying to be reckless, but that, you know, if there were a red light and there's no other cars crossing, they'd kind of get a head start on the next block. Or there's things like that that people were saying, is that essentially the transportation system we have was not built for cyclists.
Yeah.
Stop lights, stop signs, they weren't designed. They're all designed for cars in mind. So they're just doing what I think a lot of rational people would do in that situation, and that's the reason they're giving. So it's different from what drivers are doing. They're doing it for their perceived safety, which is interesting that you would break the law to feel safer.
Yeah, yeah. When you have a lot of, if you have a city with a lot of cyclists in it, and you compare one with fewer cyclists in it, in the larger city with more cyclists, I would expect that you'll have more accidents because just the raw numbers are bigger. But what about the rate for cities that have more?
That's an interesting question because that speaks to another study we're doing. And if conventional transportation engineering looks at these numbers and we say cycling is way more dangerous than driving would be, and we also know that maybe transit is way safer. So a city with a ton of transit you would expect would be a lot safer than a typical driving city. But the cities with a ton of bicycling... You would think it would be more dangerous, but in reality, they're actually way safer. Our safest cities are the ones with a ton of bicycling. Wow. And the Netherlands is one of the safest countries in the world, also has a ton of bicycling.
Well, we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much. Wes Marshall, he's an associate professor of civil engineering at University of Colorado in Denver. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
We've got one more from our Colorado Travels on our website, like a conversation with infographics guru David McCandless, who's turned everything from the Milky Way to diet studies into a beautiful, useful graphic.
Stuff I don't understand, things that frustrate and confuse me, that suggests to me there's a problem, an information problem, and I want to create a graphic that explains it.
And you can see those graphics for yourself at sciencefriday.com/infographics. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. We also like to give special thanks to Colorado Public Radio, in particular Grace Hood, Sadie Babbitts, Nate Miner, Daniel Costello, and David Fender. If you missed any part of our program, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Have a great and safe holiday weekend, 4th of July. We'll see you back in New York next week. We had a wonderful time in Aspen here and in Denver. So thank you all for making us feel so nice. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in Denver.